Live at Nightmare Studios in Houston, Texas. You're listening to the Genghis and Ragman Show, where two jamokes drink and rate craft beer while they chew the fat about the world of hard rock and heavy metal, followed up by one-on-one interviews with veterans and newcomers in the industry. I'm your official announcer, Joey Clams, and here to introduce themselves is tonight's special guest.
Hey, this is Rev Jones. I give you the right to rock.
Without further ado, here are two co-hosts who are so metal, they wear steel-belted shoes. It's Genghis and Ragman.
I guess you're on live with Ragman Mono E Mono. This is take two with a journeyman bass player extraordinaire, Mr. Rev Jones. Rev, how you doing, man?
I'm good again.
Well, I will preface this. We've been talking for about 10 minutes, and Ragman's audio device decided that it didn't want to work for a few minutes. It was ready to take a nap. So we're going to try to start this thing up again. And for you guys not familiar with Rev, Rev's played with a lot of people: Shaker, Mountain, Steelheart, Forte, a lot of different people. So rather than him regurgitate a lot of what we just spoke about, we were actually talking about some missed opportunities that are not really missed opportunities, opportunities that Rev had that he took a pass on to take other opportunities. So you were talking about Dio back in the era when Tracy was in the band, and Halford. So when you were looking at Halford, was that wasn't Resurrection type stuff, was it?
I don't remember what album it was. I think they put an album out or something, and he had some tour dates. The bass player left, and I think Roy Z ended up doing the dates. He was the guy that ended up filling in. His manager called me, and I had an album that was about to come out with Black Symphony, and we were and we were gonna do, or we were slotted to do this Rammstein tour in Europe, and with no buy-on, you know, they wanted us as the opening band.
Oh, awesome.
Which is pretty awesome, because, you know, they play to like 100,000 people a night, these huge soccer stadiums, you know, no opening band. And they love the album, so, you know, and so we had all this going, and when he called, you know, they needed somebody to at least fill in for 6 months, and I couldn't do it, you know. I tried to help find somebody, you know, and I think Roy ended up doing it on the dates they had, but it would have been, Bobby was playing drums, I know, and it would have been, yeah, like 2001 or two, maybe. Maybe 2003, mm-hmm. somewhere around that era. Which I would have, you know, I mean, another thing besides being able to, you know, sing backups with Rob, you know, would have been playing with Bobby. You know, I've known him for a long time, because he's from San Antonio, and we used to play down there. I used to see a couple of bands he was in, you know, and him and his brother Ron, I think it was his name.
Yeah, they were a Watchtower.
They had a band. I think that Bobby played in San Antonio Slayer. We're talking like late 80s, you know, when I was a little guy. But I always thought it'd be cool to play with him. He's a great, great metal drummer, you know. I didn't take the gig, and, you know, I actually got that call because of Jeff Martin as well. So I owe a bunch to Jeff Martin, you know, because that's how I got in with the Shaker deal. And that's how, you know, I met him through Black Symphony whenever I joined, because he was playing drums. And so him and Rob were like, you know, best friends back in the old Surgical Steel days, you know. So that's how I actually got in on that. But it's funny who you know, you usually get gigs from somebody that you might not even talk to anymore, you know. That's what's funny is, I actually got the Fuel gig through, at the time we had a singer that was singing at Black Symphony, Wade Williams, and, he was best friends with the bass player for Fuel.
Oh, wow.
And it was 2004, and it was the last tour that they did as the original lineup. And, his wife was pregnant, so she was gonna have a baby, and, you know, he had high blood pressure and all this, so they thought the baby might come early, so he had to have somebody to fill in for 3 to 7 weeks. You know, it depended on how long it took, you know, before she had the baby. So, I talked to him one day on the phone, and, you know, I agreed to do it. You know, those are like, they needed somebody that would use his gear instead of, you know, shipping all your gear out, because then they'd have to ship it back. And they didn't want the tech to get out of sync with this bass goes with these songs, this, you know, all the bass changes. So I agreed. I even used his bass as everything, you know.
Oh, wow.
I just came out and took over his paycheck, everything. And, but the weird thing was, I was on tour with Michael Shaker. And we had 8 weeks off, and in that 8 weeks I did 7 weeks of tour with him. And it was kind of like culture shock, because you know, Michael Shaker crowd was aging men in their, you know, 35 plus years, balding with a Scorpions or UFO shirt on, you know, from 1972. You know, that was the crowd. The Fuel crowd, they didn't even let guys in. it was like 4,000 to 8,000, you know, good looking 22-year-old girls, you know. So it's like culture shock. You come out, you're like, I don't know what to do. What do I do? You know. But that was a cool gig, actually. I mean, I wasn't familiar with, you know, any of the songs. I'd heard them, but I wasn't familiar with them. And I really couldn't learn them ahead of time, because I didn't know what bass I was going to be getting, how it was going to be tuned, you know.
Oh, wow.
So, and I didn't want to learn something wrong and then get there, because the wrong way would be stuck in my head. So I just kind of listened to them, got used to how they went, you know, and then I flew to Maine, watched them play a show, and then me and the bass player in the back of the bus from Maine to Atlanta went over the songs. And then, so then the next day, I played the first show with them. There was, which is kind of weird, there was like 30,000 people there. And it was like at the, some university there, and it was like a free show, and all you could see was people, you know. So this is my first time playing with them, and, you know, it's kind of weird. Today, in my mind, I was thinking, how are you going to act on stage, you know? Are you going to jump around, head spinning, you know? Crazy guy, or, you know, I really had no idea what was going to happen, you know, because they were more poppy rock than I'd ever played, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And, I kind of put them in that, like, buzz band category. So you went from thrash bands to a buzz band.
they're a great band, you know. It was all great. I mean, the weird thing, too, is I'd never used in-ear monitors, and you had to because they had all these backing tracks, and no amps on stage, you know, so it was like, it was a completely different thing, but I mean, you know, I nailed it, you know, everything fell into place just like it should, and the weird thing was that they wanted to change the order of the songs, and I was like, oh, time out, I don't know the names. I just know that this song goes into that one, and this one goes into that one. I don't know what they're called, you know, and it's kind of funny, but so I did that for like right about 7 weeks, and so then, you know, we played in Florida, and then they said, yeah, you're going home tomorrow. I'm like, cool. So I stayed an extra day in Florida there, then I get home, I don't talk to anybody, then the next day everybody starts calling me going, what happened? And evidently the next day the bass player came back and they played one show, and during the show the drummer quit, and then the next day after that they played an acoustic thing, and then Brett quit, the singer.
Oh, wow.
And so and there was no fighting or bickering whatsoever while I was there. You know, I realized that it was probably they'd wait until I wasn't around, because, you know, you don't want everybody to know your business, but I was just as shocked as everybody else, you know.
Wow, and, it just like imploded as soon as you left.
Yeah, there was stuff going on, you know, internally with them all, and, you know, it's any band like that, when you get to that point of selling that many records, you know, that album was like a failure because it sold like 700,000.
Wow.
Yeah. But the one before sold like 10 million.
Uh-huh.
You know, and, which, you know, 700,000, that's an awesome failure.
Yeah, no shit. <You know?
laughs> So, you know, it's like, anytime that you're in that kind of situation, there's one or two people that are writing all those songs that are getting all that money, and then you got one or two people that are saying, hey, my songs are good, listen. And they're going, no, Peter, get behind the drums. You know, you know, it's that thing that, you know, I've seen a lot of those guys, a lot of those bands, that's what happens to them, you know. I mean, I know a couple of bands. I mean, hell, I know Paul Gilbert wanted to, you know, after the first Mr. Big album, he like wanted to leave, you know, and just do his thing. And their manager, you know, talked him into staying, is what I understand. And it's a good thing, because right after he talked him into staying, you know, To Be With You became a, you know, number one. You know, it's, you know, that set him up, you know, to where,
oh, yeah,
you know, then he could do it forever, you know. Plus, the coolest thing about that is when I was recording with Paul Gilbert at his house, on his wall was the Billboard sheet for that week when it became number one. And the coolest thing about that is that the song that it knocked out had been there for, I don't know, like 30 weeks or something, and it was I'm Too Sexy.
Oh, right, said Fred.
So, I mean, yeah, there's nothing cooler than having that on your wall.
No joke, man. And that's interesting. I never knew that about Paul. We've talked to Billy before. Never talked to Paul. We've talked to Eric Martin quite a bit. But, you know, you think about where he came from Racer X into that Mr. Big fold. I mean, such a departure from Racer X. But
well, you know, if you listen to his solo stuff, you know, it's especially the early solo stuff, it's more poppy. And I mean, Paul always, as long as I've known him, has always been like that. You know, he likes the cool Beatles type, you know, melodies and that kind of thing. You know, and he loves the Killer playing, but Paul's also the guy that, and there's very few of these, that is so fast and so technical that he could actually play something that's so simple, you know?
Yeah.
And most guys, you're not going to get them to play some simple, you know, basic kind of thing, you know, because they can't do that. They're a shredder, you know? And Paul will. He'll, you know, play the most simple thing that you could, you know, you could do there, if that's what sounds good, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that it was more, I mean, I don't think that he had a problem with Mr. Big, you know. I think it was just that he wanted to go a different direction, you know, all it was. And, I mean, who would have known that they would have been huge, you know, on that album. And, you know, I loved all the songs. They're great songs, you know. And I like the poppy side of it, you know. I mean, I love any time that you're going to hear a band that's really basic and poppy and cool, but everybody's so talented that, you know, and there's nothing going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
You take these great players and then you keep the song so simple, and then you do, you know, 3 seconds of something, you know, that explodes at you, and, you know, it's like, oh my God, what was that? Yeah, like a bomb went off or something.
I always thought he would be good in like Enough's Enough. That kind of Beatles poppy type thing.
Yeah, that's what the albums that he did. That's what they sound like. You know, I mean, they kind of, you know, they have that, you know, that big sound. I mean, when I recorded with him there, that was the Alligator Farm, and you know, we were I went there to his house and did all the pre-production and everything, and you know, he did When Two Become One, Spice Girls. On that album, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so cool every time I hear it, you know. And then there was a couple of songs did make it on there that were, you know, like almost like Fountains of Wayne or one of those, you know, those poppy, almost, you know, like Blink 182, almost that kind of, you know, poppy punk. You know, you don't know how to describe it. You just know that kids listen to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were great songs, you know. That if I played them for you, you would go, there's no way that's Paul. You know? But at the same time, if you tried to play some of the stuff he was playing, you know, it was really hard, even though it sounded so basic and simple, you know. I mean, he's a great guy. Probably one of the coolest guys I ever, you know, playing-wise ever played with, you know. It's like every time you go to his house, all he wants to do is show you some weird website that he found, you know, where they just display the worst band photos in history, you know, or something cheesy like that. And he's like a little kid showing, oh, look at this, you know. And I mean, he's a sweetheart of a guy, you know. And then, you know, of course, the playing, you don't even have to say anything about that, you know.
Yeah, no joke, man.
Paul Gilbert can walk by a guitar that's got action high enough that you could put your hand between the strings and the neck. And he could play, just grab it and start playing like it was set up for him, you know?
Wow, that's wild, man.
It's amazing. But
well, how did you get hooked up with Steelheart? That's when the first time I ever, to be honest, the first time I'd seen you was on that Rockin' Milan DVD. And, man, I gotta say that version of Steelheart, what a strong band. It's unfortunate the guitar player passed away, but.
It was a weird joke because that all falls, like I said, everything's like a domino, you know. The whole time I was in Black Symphony, we had singer problems. Like, you know, we did an album and then we, got rid of the singer, got another singer, did the album, did a third album, and then, which is the one when I was supposed to go play with Rob, the singer quit before the album came out. So it didn't come out. Maybe 6 years later, we had another singer that we did we released the third and fourth album together, you know, so he went back and re-sang. But, you know, so all that time we were auditioning these singers. And we probably went through everybody in that, you know, that was in LA. because that's kind of where the band was based out of. And we had talked to Nils Losauer. He's a famous rock photographer.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Even in the movie Rockstar, he's the photographer. Told him not to smile. We were talking to him about it. He said you should talk to Billy McKibben from Steelheart. You know, Billy was crashing on his couch while he was in town. So he gave us Billy's number, and then we had an ad in, you know, one of the little trade magazines out there. So we got a call from a guy, and I called and left a message with Billy. So all of a sudden we're talking to Billy. We still don't know if we were calling him back because he called about the ad, or if he was calling us back because we called. You know, I still don't know which one was which, because both happened the same day, you know. So he ends up coming up, and here's our stuff. We hang out for, you know, hour and a half just talking, you know. And of course, it was, you know, he wasn't fit for that. He didn't like, you know, really dig that style and blah blah. But over the next couple of years, every time he was thinking about putting the band back together, he kept thinking about me, you know. And just because we hit it off, you know, loved to play in, you know, we hit it as our personalities and everything. So in 2006, it was the last year that I was actually a full band member at MSG. I was actually just leaving the band because I had I was tired of the management and stuff. So I was actually leaving, and he called me to see if I wanted to, you know, come and check out the album they were working on, and, you know, they were going to do a short tour. And I said, sure, I'd love to. Then I get a call from management of MXD that even though I've left the band, I still have to go and do 2 weeks in Asia because I've already been paid my last week of pay, you know. So I ended up not doing the tour with Steelheart and went and did this Asia thing that was a disaster with MXD. Came back and forgot about their Steelheart for about 3 or 4 weeks, and then he called and said, hey, we're gonna cut the last few tracks, you want to come out and do them, you know. So I flew out, played on the songs, we hung out for 2 or 3 days, and, you know, actually joined right then, you know. And I was always a fan of him more so than the band. I mean, I never really listened to the songs, the Steelheart songs back then when they were out. I thought they were great. I mean, Chris Rizzola, the guitar player, he was killer, you know. And Billy's a great singer. You know, I didn't really care for the songs at the time, you know, because I was younger and, you know, I didn't dress like that. But, I ended up joining, and that the first lineup when I came in was with Chris Rizzola, the original, and we had 3 or 4 different second guitar players over the course of like 3 years. And then I brought the point up that we didn't really need a second guitar player except for the beginning of Angel Eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And because nothing else needed it, and if we did, Millie could play, you know. So we scratched that second guitar player out, which made it to where, all right, now I can really play bass, you know. If you got 2 guitar players, it's hard to really do anything on bass because, you know, now you're just going to muddy it up because there's too much going on, you know.
Right.
So that lined up with Chris. And then, you know, that kind of fell out with it because Chris and Millie were both in the band the whole time, and they had, you know, it was like almost like a divorced couple that still worked together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't really feuding, but there was a lot of resentment, you know, things like this over the years. So Chris left, and you got another guy, Uros, that played on, you know, the album. He actually played on that, the last Steelheart album too, great player. And then because he's from Europe, he started having a problem with this travel thing. So we were still looking for another guy, you know. And Kenny Tadowski, had played on the third Steelheart album. He, you know, he co-wrote, like, We All Die Young, you know, that was in the Rockstar movie.
Yeah.
You know, great, he was a great guitar player, great singer. And which is weird because I had just met him. I was on an MSG tour, and I had just met him. I'd never met him over these years. And right before this, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're calling him to come back and, you know, do dates with us. You know, so he came back and played, and it was a great lineup because, you know, me and him both having strong voices. You know, if you watch on the DVD, Milly doesn't have to sing on the choruses, you know. He can do the singer thing where he's holding the mic out, you know, and it's just us singing the choruses, you know. And which people don't think about as much, but that's such a, you know, a good thing for a singer because saving your voice, you know, getting the crowd into it more, you know, it's all those kind of things. But, yeah, it was a shame. That was the last show that I did with him, and that was the last show that Kenny did, period, I think.
Wow. Yeah, man, I tell you what, that was, they were so heavy, and I actually saw them in Houston last summer, and they were good, but, man, I missed some of that. It just wasn't heavy enough for me. I liked the heavier side of the band, and guitar player, he was good, but his sound was kind of thin, and Kenny, man, just, he had that, I wouldn't say Zakk Wylde sound, but, man, he sounded good, man.
Yeah, well, even, you know, the first time Kenny came back and played with us, it was a fill-in thing on a festival. And, you know, when he got there, I was like, you know, I don't even know if this is going to work, because, you know, but he just, you know, even if he doesn't look, he's not dressed like everybody else, you know, like, he doesn't look as rock star looking, you know, right off, but then you see him on stage, and there's so much confidence in his playing, and his singing, and the way he is, that you're going, what was I thinking? I mean, it's you know, it's like, it's more natural. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, it's not, he's not trying to do that. You know, like, I don't try to come across a certain way. It just, you know, it happens. I'm cursed with it, you know. If I want to change, I'm screwed, you know. But, you know, Kenny had that, you know, and he was a, you know, like I said, he was a great, great player, and I don't know how long it would have lasted with him, you know, because there was, same deal, there was a lot of, you know, kind of hidden resentments, you know, kind of, you know, from him being in the band before that, and, you know, and then, you know, being fired or leaving or whatever, you know, so there was always that kind of thing, so I'm not sure how much longer that would have lasted, you know, but that was, you know, I just watched the DVD actually yesterday for the first time, and I was actually pretty blown away by, you know, the performance, because it seemed like that day I kept thinking that was okay, you know, but I watched it last night and I thought it was I didn't really notice anything bad at all, you know.
Yeah, it's really strong performance, man, for sure. Yeah. Well, I tell you what, let's jump into your new record, Backwash. How long have you had these songs, and how long have you been wanting to do your own thing?
Well, there's like three or four of these songs that back in 94, before I joined any of these bands, I was trying to put a thing called Backwash together. That was going to be the name of the band, with a couple of friends here, and, you know, I had this whole thing, you know, how I wanted it to be kind of, you know, ZZ Top, Van Halen, you know, kind of, you know, riffs, and, you know, where it's more fun, I guess, you know. So I wrote these songs, and then one guy flaked out, the other guy flaked out, and they just kind of went into, as Gene Simmons would say, the vault, you know. And so over time, there was a bunch of times that I'd bring those songs out, and like, hey, you know, maybe this will work, but I never was in a band that they would work with, you know. So probably about 2007, I started doing, when I was at home off tour, I would do Rev Jones shows, you know. We would play, you know, some cool cover songs, play MSG and Steelheart, you know, whoever I was playing with, you know. And we would do a couple of, you know, originals that I'd never put out. So a couple of years ago, I was trying to put another lineup together to do it, so I pulled out those songs and a couple of other ones that I'd written, you know, that never got put out, and I was recording them only for the reason of those guys learning them, you know. And then I decided maybe I'll just put it out and give it away free on my website, you know. So I contacted Jim Dofka to play all the solos on it, and I sent him those. It was like five songs, I think, and I sent it to him to do the solos, and he called me and talked me out of giving it away. You know, he's like, I think there's something cool here. You should, you know, do a full album. And, you know, so that conversation, I said, okay. I took, you know, I took his outsider, you know, thought on it and said, okay, I'll believe you then. You know, so I, you know, at that point, said, you know, I just kind of left those five songs the same. I maybe replaced one vocal and one song I redid the bass on, you know. So of those five songs, most of it's all they're scratch tracks, you know. I just didn't, I mean, something about the vibe when I did them that day was, you know, was perfect. And you know, I didn't think I needed to go and over think the song, you know, and, oh, right. I'm gonna do that a million times like everybody else does these days, you know. So then I gotta write five more songs, you know. So I just kinda went through some stuff that I had, you know. I got probably 100-200 killer ideas for songs that I have never had a place to put them, you know. And so since it's my solo album, I can put them wherever I want, you know. If I got a reggae riff and then I got this Slayer riff, I'm gonna put them together.
Yeah. Nice.
I'm not trying to, you know, oh, this is my new, you know, hit record, you know. I'm not trying to, you know, not trying to fall into an exact thought of, okay, I'm going to do an album, we're going to sound exactly like this, this is our goal, you know. So having that freedom of just saying, all right, I'm just going to write a song, this sounds good, put it on there, you know, that actually helped the album, you know, because most of the big compliments I get on it is how it doesn't sound like, it all sounds like one band, but they're not the same kind of songs, you know. It's like not all poppy, not all thrash, not all, you know, prog or whatever. It just sounds like Rev Jones, you know, and which that's what, you know, that was my whole point anyway, is of doing it. When I think back of bands like Queen, you know, what I loved about Queen is they didn't really have a style, you know. You can't say it was rock, you can't say it was, you know, progressive, you can't say, you know, it was pop, funk, you know, because it was all of them,
mm-hmm.
You know. And so that's kind of how I look at it, you know, because you couldn't tell me which songs were written in 94 and which were written, you know, 2 years ago.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
They all, you know, and the ones that were written in 94, zero things changed on it. The lyrics, nothing. Everything's exactly as I wrote it that day, you know. And just because in my mind, I think of when you write something, whatever influenced you to write that, that influence isn't going to be there 2 years later, you know. So that could be a good thing because now you might have a more creative next part, or you don't like that part anymore, but there was a reason it was there, you know. I don't know if you understand what I'm talking about.
Oh,
there.
Oh yeah, yeah, totally, totally,
it,
man.
Yeah, it's you know, it's just one of those things that I've heard people take 3 or 4 years to put something out. You know, redoing this, redoing that, changing this, changing that, add a bunch of guitar solos, take all the guitar solos out, you know, and to where if you go back and listen to the first day they recorded, it's 100 times better. You know, it's the problem with technology as it gets better, things don't get better, you know.
Oh yeah, you can overthink something, you know.
Yeah, I mean the song Ring of Pain, the second song, I sing that was the first time I ever sang the song, and that's one take through the whole song.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
I maybe like punched a couple of things that, but it was on that initial day, and when I went back to re-sing it later, I couldn't capture that same emotion, I guess, you know. But I'd listen, it didn't sound as good, you know. That day I was really, you know, irritated with my ex-wife, and that this song is kind of about that. You know, I mean, that's what it's basically the storyline is, even though it's written to where the words sound good together. It's not really a true story, but that kind of anger that was there on the day I sang it, you know, helped it. And I couldn't, you know, after that, I couldn't do it. You know, I mean, I still think it's great when I do it live, but when you're trying to capture a moment, you know, you don't want to ruin it. I probably could have sang it, you know, added much more, you know, kind of runs and things, but I didn't really think of it that way. I just thought of it how that sounds perfect, you know. That's what I wanted to sell it.
Well, I like the variety on the record too, Rev. With, you know, like you said, you kind of have that ZZ Top, Van Halen, or even I even thought a little Mr. Big with, I guess, the Billy Sheehan, Paul Gilbert comparison with runs. So a lot of bands don't do that anymore. I really like what you and Jim are doing with these runs, being both awesome musicians. I really kind of miss that stuff in rock.
You know, it's like, it's like I said, you know, the thing about, like, if it's done right, it's perfect, you know. When you go back and listen to, like, Talus, you know, I love Billy Sheehan, you know, he's a fucking great guy, you know, great player, of course. But, when, you know, I used to love Talus. But when I go back and listen to it now, the problem with Talus was it was just Billy doing a bunch of stuff the whole time. And they were really good songs, but it wasn't the same. Then you put him and Vi doing David Lee Roth songs, you know.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my God, that's killer. You know,
exactly. Now, yeah.
Because it's also placed, you know, it's one of those things you could solo the whole time, and if it doesn't seem like it needs to be there, it's going to seem much, you know.
Right.
And so that's what I think the beauty of it was. And I mean, at the same time, I hated that whenever Mr. Big, when it came out, I remember seeing, waiting for that video because I knew all about the band before the first video came out. And then I seen Addicted to That Rush. I'm like, oh, yes, finally. You know, somebody's doing it right, you know. Mm-hmm. And but then what sucked is that as it, you know, you got to that third album and, you know, it became more Eric Martin songs, you know, that didn't have as much of that vibe anymore, you know, because once you sell a million records, now you have a different thing that's coming down on you, like either sell a million or you're a failure, you know.
Right.
So at that point, people stop thinking about the cool parts of the songs and, you know, what brought them there, and they, you know, they go a completely different way, you know. And but yeah, I, you know, Jim's playing was perfect, you know, adding Jim Dofka in this thing, you know, because of all the guitar players I've played with, probably the two most like magical kind of creative playing guys, you know, would be Paul Gilbert and Jim, of all the guys I played with.
Oh, wow.
You know, because like the Backwash and Ring of Pain, both of those. But I sent them to him, maybe like 15 minutes later, he had sent me a MP3 of their solo. He's like, something like this, And I was like, don't change that. I mean, what's on there is the first thing that he, you know, that he recorded, wrote right off the top of his head. You know, there's some amazing stuff in there. I mean, just creativity wise, you know, it's not, you know, it's not, can you play that? It's so fast, or can you play this? It's so weird. It's that it fits in so well, you know, kind of like, if you, you know, like somebody like Randy Rhoads, what he was playing, was it hard to do? It's just that it was so musical, you know. Yeah, everybody always constantly thinks of classical, but that's why, it's because you listen to Bach or one of those guys, everything's in patterns, you know, little phrase, you know. And so that's how Randy Rhoads did all his solos, you know. They were all these little patterns that you could actually sing each little part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And because nobody was really doing that, because everybody was kind of being more with that Jimmy Page kind of bluesy thing, to where it wasn't really musical anymore. It was like, it's just a guitar solo,
right,
instead of it's a musical part of the song. And but that's how, you know, that's how I look at Jim's playing, is that it's like that. Everything that he's played, period, that he's recorded for me, sounds like that, you know. And we actually did, the way I got Jim into it was, I met him via actual physical handwritten mail.
Oh,
back
really?
In the 80s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I met him through, there was a band called Mystic Forest that we used to play shows with out of Baltimore. And that's how I, you know, actually met him back then. I, over the years, we'd, you know, talk or whatever. And we started talking about Steve Moore. He's the drummer. Everybody's seen him on YouTube, the drummer at the Wrong Gig. You know, he's playing in a casino, doing Sharp Dressed Man, crazy arm stuff going on, you know. And, you know, that video's been viewed like 20, 30 million times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was the drummer for Dafka. So, because of that video success of him doing that song, we never finished it. We recorded a heavy version of Sharp Dressed Man with Jeff Martin singing.
Oh, nice.
And you know, Steve doing his thing. And we never finished it because right in the process of doing it, Steve got an idea to do Little Drummer Boy because it was coming up on Christmas. So in one day, they sent me and Jeff the tracks, and we did our parts and sent them back. The next day, Jim mixed it, and Steve did a video for it. The next day, we put it out on, you know, on YouTube, you know. And but it's pretty cool because it's this heavy version, Little Drummer Boy. And if you listen to Jim's guitar stuff that he wrote on it, it's so musical that it almost seems like it was there before, you know.
Oh, wow.
And but that's how the whole thing started. We were actually going to try to do a full album of that that lineup, and Steve was so busy with his casino gigs, you know, that he's became famous with, you know, because they play five nights a week and they make huge money, you know, that it just never happened. And so that's how I actually was in contact with Jim again. But and I'm glad, because I don't think anybody else really would have fit that guitar role as good as Jim, you know.
Oh, yeah.
There's great players, there's amazing players, there's okay players, but it's the guy that fits, you know.
Yeah, that chemistry, you know, man.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's, and it's that whole thing of being yourself. How, you know, if you can be yourself and fit in it, then that's perfect. Like Michael Schenker, he can play on anything, but no matter what, it's always going to sound like Michael Schenker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he played on, we did a Jeff Martin solo album, and the song that Schenker played on, it's so out of the pocket of, you know, of what's going on, but it's Schenker, you know.
Yeah.
You're just going, wow, that's killer, you know. But, you know, it was kind of cool because the song was nothing like a Michael Schenker song, you know, and so it fit perfect. But
awesome, man. Well, I want to ask you about another track on the record. I really dig New Drug. And the intro kind of, I don't know, I may be off in left field, but almost has kind of like a 80s Kansas vibe mixed with some Genesis, and then it goes into a whole different thing. It's kind of cool the way that whole song came together.
Exactly how, you know, I mean, I finished them like right then, you know. That one, the first thing I wrote was the chorus, just the vocal lines, you know, and the lyric. And so the next thing, of course, was the guitar that's under that, which is that opening, you know, the opening part. So that's basically that guitar part that matches the vocal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I started writing it, and over the course of, you know, a year, I had probably five different verses and choruses. I mean, verses and pre-choruses, and I would like have the whole song done, and then I'd listen to it and go, no. And then I would cut those parts and, you know, do something else and try something else, and to the point to where when I was finishing up the record, the last thing I thought of on that song was what is in there now, you know. And so it's weird because the song, if you play the song a certain way, it sounds different, you know. Originally, everybody was getting that it sounded like a Van Halen song, you know, because of the guitar part, you know, it was kind of like something that he would do. It's not like something he's done, but it sounds like something that he would have done, you know.
Yeah.
And so that made me have to change what I'm playing underneath it on bass and drums, you know. Where instead of playing it, you know, more rock, I had to play it more, you know, with that kind of dance, do pop, 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 you know.
Yeah, that's the part that kind of reminds me of Kansas, like something off like Play the Game or something like that, you know, or Fight Fire with Fire.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I had to add that groove to it, and then once I did that, it was like, oh, that's killer, you know, that makes that part jump, you know. And you know, then I came up with that kind of AC/DC kind of rhythm, you know, dump, ba 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 ba, you know.
Yeah.
Part. And once I came up with that and decided to put it there, to make it not sound like AC/DC, I actually, you listen to the bass under it, I'm going boo ba ba boo ba ba ba, you know, like big slides.
Uh-huh.
No pattern that seems normal, you know, for playing that song. And once I did that, it made the song sound different again, you know. And which immediately the first thing I started singing was what's on there, you know. So it kind of, all of a sudden, that song that I couldn't make satisfying to me, all of a sudden was oversatisfied, you know. Just in a, you know, in a matter of a day, you know. So it's, you know, and it's funny because that's the song that gets the most comments about it.
Well, it's a killer track, man.
Yeah, and you know, there's nothing at all that there's nothing. You know, I'll tell you this: there's nothing on the album that I don't like. You know, I can listen to it. That's but over the, you know, the 6 months that it wasn't that I didn't put it out. You know, I was trying to. I shopped it around a little bit. Everybody was offering, you know, like they always do. Here's $5. We'll put it out. Not promoted. You know. So in that process of doing that and deciding to put it out myself, I listened to it, you know, hundreds of times. And I'd be in my car, I'd throw it in, and just listen to it. And really, from an outsider's perspective, you know, I didn't listen to it critiquing anything I did, you know. I've just listened to it, because if I couldn't grow a love for it without going, oh, I hate that part, you know, then I can't expect anybody else to, you know. And sometimes I'd even forget it was that I recorded it, you know. I would be listening and kind of, you know, catching the rhythm and, you know, singing along, and then I'd realize, oh, that's me, you know. So that's when, you know, that's when you can release it. That's when it's good, you know.
Yeah, for sure, man, for sure.
Well, I'm glad I waited too, because I think if I'd have put it out right away, if I'd have put it out and gave it away like my initial plan, I don't think it would have been as cool, you know, because the last thing that we added, you know, after Jim did his parts and all that, the last thing we recorded was the drums, because the original tracks were either me or my buddy Kerry that lives here playing drums. So we replaced everything with Jeff Martin. And that was the last thing that was added, you know, which is kind of a weird way of doing, you know, an album. But
yeah,
it made it better for one, because the songs were written to a groove I had, you know. So if you have a drummer play it, now you're playing to his groove, and which is not bad. But I was able to capture what was in my head of hearing the song instead of altering it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it also opened up where he could do fills, you know, because he knows exactly what's there. Nothing else is going in this spot, and he can go, oh wow, I can do this oddball, you know, like Ian Pace type fill, you know, that would never fit if you were trying to. I don't think I could have played to them some of those fills that were there, you know, but it made it to where it, you know, it molded perfect. You know, it's like that was, I think, you know, and it was hard for Jeff to do it, you know, but I think that was a very good combo of how his playing ended up being in the songs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, that was kind of it's how it happened. I never even, like I said, I never intended for it to actually all work and come out, you know. And then once it was done, I was, you know, very satisfied. So now my goal is to get everybody in the world to buy a copy, or at least hear it, you know, because I'm more concerned with sharing it with people, you know, where they'll know about me, you know, they'll enjoy the songs, you know, whatever it may be, you know. I definitely want to make money, but I'm a realist. I know that it's not going to sell a million copies. And nobody really sells a million copies anymore, you know.
No, I know, it's sad, huh?
Yeah, but you know, it is what it is, you know. It's like, you can't really fix, once you break something bad, you know, you can't really fix it. There's always going to be the people that still buy vinyl, still listen to albums on vinyl, you know. It does sound amazing, you know, but most people don't really care what it sounds like. You know, you spend a bunch of money to make this incredible sounding record. You know, you record it, you know, all the new technology, it's, you know, it was done this way and this way, and then somebody listens to it as an MP3. You know, so you break it back down to cassette quality, you know?
Yeah.
And, or, you know, it's kind of like you would spend millions of dollars in the old days doing an album that they're going to listen to on the radio, you know, through little bitty speakers, you know. It's always kind of been that weird thing that people follow. So now it's like people don't even care. They can get the worst version of a song, you know, and enjoy it instead of buy the record, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a shame, but I don't think that, you know, I don't think that rock's dead. You know, I mean, I see enough of touring with all these bands that people still go to shows, you know. I work with George Thorogood. When I'm not on the road playing, I go out and I'm his guitar tech, you know. And so every night on the road with him, I see these people, you know, he's making huge money, you know, big crowds, you know, rock's not dead.
Well, Rev, before we let you go today, man, is there anything you would like to tell the fans out there?
Yeah, make sure you buy Rev Jones Backwash. It comes with a free picture of Rev Jones at 12 months old holding what appears to be an alcoholic beverage. And that picture comes free on the album cover. And it's for everybody to enjoy.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Rev,
Check out my, go to revjones.com. If you're a bass player, every month I put a free, video bass lesson up where I show you how to play one of the songs from my career, I guess. And, if you're interested, you could get Skype bass lessons from me on there. And, all the other info about me, tours, where I'm going to be at, blah, blah. It's all there. RevJones.com.
Awesome. Well, Rev, we want to thank you for coming on the Right to Rock and the Genghis and Ragman show. And we want to tell the fans to grab Rev Jones' Backwash. It's badass, guys. Check it out. Rev, awesome talking to you, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Let's kill it.
All right, dude. Well, good
Sorry
luck.
Sorry that Genghis couldn't be there.
I know. He whipped out, didn't he?
Yeah, I know. It's only 6 in the morning.
Why? Yeah.
I don't even know why he's sleeping.
Well, Rev, man, you're welcome back on our show anytime, dude. I had a lot of fun talking to you, man.
I appreciate it, man.
Podcast, and we appreciate you listening, and we want to give a big thank you to Tracy G who is the third unofficial member of the Groom. We appreciate all of his work, especially the Broken Man song, which is the theme song to the Right to Rock podcast.
Also, we're going to give high props to our boys in Sonic X. Adam and Joseph have lent us 13 to finish the show, so what you're listening to right now is 13 by Sonic X. So check them out, and keep checking us out. And horns up.